The reason we're doing it this is because abortion is incredibly important. One out of every three women will have an abortion in her lifetime.
The ACLU and Planned Parenthood sue the state over laws concerning second trimester abortions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 30th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, conflicting federal gun regulations and Alaska's legal marijuana laws get attention from Alaska's senior senator.
You have a weird situation with wiggle room, and that's not good public policy. It's not good public safety.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Donald Trump transition team hasn't named a Veterans Administration secretary yet, but news broke today that ex-Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is vying for the job. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Several news outlets, including ABC, NBC, and The New York Times, report Palin is interested in running the Department of Veterans Affairs and is under consideration. The news accounts cite unnamed aides close to Palin and the Trump team. Palin acknowledged the reports on Facebook and Twitter. She posted a link to the ABC story and also a video of herself speaking about veterans. It begins with accolades from her son-in-law, Medal of Honor recipient Dakota Meyer.
The amazing woman that I'm introducing knows what veterans have been through. She knows because she's lived it.
Palin's son, Track, is an Army veteran who served in Iraq in 2008. At campaign rallies for Trump and at national conservative conferences, she repeatedly spoke about vets' issues. She used one of those speeches from 2015 in a video to promote SARAPAC, her political action committee. In it, Palin criticizes VA bureaucracy, which she says is killing vets, and she offers a three-point plan to help veterans.
First with health care, give vouchers for treatment outside the VA.
That seems to be the approach Congress took with the VA Choice Card. Vets, particularly in Alaska, complain the program adds more layers of bureaucracy. Palin's second suggestion was to make it easier for skilled vets to get civilian jobs.
Let them use the skills that they learned in the military. Let them test out, and their military certification can transfer over. Common sense.
That common sense has occurred to others, too. It's the aim of multiple laws and government programs stretching back years. Palin's third point was that Congress should secure veterans' benefits and not cut them. Last year, Palin told CNN she wanted to be Trump's energy secretary.
Because energy is my baby. Oil and gas and minerals, those things that God has dumped on this part of the earth for mankind's use.
Palin's name has also been floated as a possible Secretary of the Interior, the department that manages most federal lands and regulates oil and gas development. But another former governor is said to be on the short list for Interior, Mary Phelan of Oklahoma. Senator Dan Sullivan, who sits on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, was the state attorney general under Palin. Sullivan spokesman Mike Anderson says in Alaska, with the highest number of vets per capita, the VA job is critical.
Senator Sullivan has much respect for Governor Palin and believes that our state would be well served with an Alaskan serving in President-elect Trump's cabinet.
Palin may have a champion in Steve Bannon, Trump's chief strategist. In 2011, Bannon made a two-hour movie lauding the former Alaska governor for her guts in taking on the establishment. But it's not clear Palin is the favorite for the job. Former U.S. Senator Scott Brown of Massachusetts has been spotted in the lobby at Trump Tower, and he told reporters he thinks he's the best candidate for VA secretary. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Today, the ACLU of Alaska filed suit against the state, challenging restrictions on second trimester abortions. Planned Parenthood Votes of the Great Northwest and Hawaii and Center for Reproductive Rights joined the ACLU as plaintiffs. Joshua Decker, ACLU Alaska Executive Director, says three 1970s-era restrictions are obstacles to women's reproductive health because they ban second trimester abortions in outpatient clinics and force some women to seek the procedure out of state.
The reason we're doing this is because abortion is incredibly important. One out of every three women will have an abortion in her lifetime. The number one reason in terms of women's ability to fully and equally participate in lives as Americans, in terms of economic prospects, in terms of jobs, in terms of education, it is the ability to decide by themselves and in consultation with their physicians when and if to have a pregnancy, be carried to term, when and if to have a child, when and if to be a parent.
The restrictions require Alaska abortion providers to get a second opinion, to have blood and plasma supplies on hand at the clinic, and to have an operating room immediately available. Tara Rich, legal and policy director for ACLU Alaska, says the suit challenges the constitutionality of the restrictions under the Alaska Constitution provisions for privacy, equal protections, and due process.
So the Alaska Supreme Court is a much stronger test than the federal constitution, which is that an infringement on a woman's right to abortion cannot present an undue burden to that woman's right. We are challenging these regulations under the Alaska Constitution and not the federal constitution.
Jessica Clare, public relations manager for Planned Parenthood Votes Northwest and Hawaii, says Planned Parenthood sends about 30 women a year out of state to its clinics in Idaho and Washington for second trimester abortions. State Department of Health and Social Services Public Information Officer Rebecca Lynch says the department is not issuing a statement on the legal challenge at this time. ACLU Alaska joined with ACLU in Missouri and North Carolina in filing lawsuits against abortion restrictions. When Americans buy guns, they're asked whether they use marijuana. If they say yes, they can't buy the gun. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski wants to change that, and some Alaskan gun sellers, marijuana industry advocates, and local officials applaud the move. APRN's and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Juneau Assemblymember Jesse Keel owns several rifles and pistols, and he also supported the ballot question legalizing marijuana in Alaska. Keel was pleased when the Wall Street Journal reported that Senator Murkowski wants the federal government to stop asking whether gun buyers use marijuana.
Where you have a conflict between a federal law that maybe doesn't make a lot of sense and a privacy right that the Alaska Constitution respects and that now Alaska law respects, you have a weird situation with wiggle room. And that's not good public policy. It's not good public safety.
Murkowski asked U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch whether Lynch could change the policy requiring gun buyers to answer the question on the federal firearms transaction record if they're unlawful users of or addicted to marijuana, or if a new law is needed. Murkowski noted an Alaska ballot question 2 years ago set rules for legally growing and selling marijuana. Legal marijuana sales started in Valdez in October and have been rolling out in other parts of Alaska. The Department of Justice said in its response that the department was enforcing federal drug and gun control laws. In an email, Murkowski said she's disappointed with the reply because it reflects a bias against firearm owners. Some gun sellers don't like the question, including John Weedman. He's the general manager of Western Auto Marine, a Juneau store that sells guns. He says that with the change in state law, the federal question is outdated. Weedman, his real name just a coincidence, says he hasn't heard concerns from customers.
If an applicant puts down on the form that they're not a user of marijuana, we have no way to verify one way or another on that, okay? And we have no obligation to do that. We have a reasonable suspicion they come in smelling like pot, then yeah, that's a different story.
Bruce Schulte is the former chairman of the Alaska Marijuana Control Board and former spokesman for the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation. He says in the short term, he'd like to see the federal government stop asking the question about pot use. In the long term, he says new federal laws are needed.
The question alone, it harkens back to an attitude towards marijuana that's just not in sync with current social norms.
Schulte notes that the federal government doesn't ask about alcohol use on the firearms transaction form, though he says it's more dangerous. He also says some injured military veterans may choose to use marijuana rather than prescription opioids, whose use combined with guns could also be more dangerous. It's a point reinforced by Keel, the Juneau Assembly member.
I've filled out this form quite a few times myself, and it does not ask if you ever take the gun out of where it's stored when you've been drinking. It does not ask if you take a perfectly legal prescription medication that makes you dopey as a side effect.
What happens with federal enforcement of marijuana laws and how they interact with legalization in Alaska and other states will depend on the next attorney general. President-elect Donald Trump's choice is Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. Sessions opposes legal marijuana, but it's not clear how he'll handle state legalization. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Fairbanks schools will be the first in Alaska to implement a new education model that'll transform the traditional school day.
This whole idea of, you know, sitting in a desk for 6 hours a day is just going to start changing.
North Star Borough Schools Superintendent Karen Gaborik says the district is contracting with national consulting firm Education Elements on the $1.6 million learning project to revamp the way kids and teachers interact.
Start to shift our thinking around how we group kids. So grouping kids around their learning needs and their learning pace instead of age and grade.
Gaborik says technology will play a major role as a source of information and a platform for interaction.
A teacher and a textbook to give us the information like we used to. I mean, it's available to anybody. So now the teacher becomes more a facilitator of learning, teaching students how to consume information, critically, how to use that information to be creative, to innovate, and then teaching students how to collaborate and really getting at some of those skills that the workforce now needs from students that are graduating from our systems.
Gaborik says the changes vary depending on grade level, but can radically alter the daily format, with kids attending school less than 5 days a week and completing courses at their own pace.
And that'll be very interesting at the high school level, because you're going to have some kids that do not need 4 years to get a high school diploma. So then we want to put in place some options for them to start earning college credit, associate's degrees, industry certifications, do internships, things like that.
Gaborik emphasizes that students, parents, and teachers will still share responsibility to make sure kids are learning. She says the program will begin to be rolled out at the elementary level next semester, with changes at the higher grades over the following 3 years. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska professor, a long road trip, and a DeLorean. What could go wrong?
There were moments where I thought this is a huge, huge, huge mistake.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Dozens of Alaska firefighters are battling blazes in the lower 48, including the deadly Tennessee fires that have destroyed or damaged hundreds of buildings. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Fire crews from around the United States are working to extinguish more than a dozen blazes around Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, which, as of noon Wednesday, have left 7 people dead. Alaska Division of Forestry Public Information Officer Tim Mowry says more than 20 Alaska-based staff were in Tennessee earlier this week when the fire became deadly.
That night before, I talked to one of our guys down there, and he said the winds were blowing in excess of 80 miles an hour.
More than 700 buildings have been damaged or destroyed in Sevier County. At its peak, about 110 Alaska-based personnel were scattered around the southeast U.S. fighting fires in the drought-stricken region. Mowry was among the deployed and spent 2 weeks working in North Carolina. He says Alaskans are filling a variety of roles, ranging from support staff to initial attack crews.
Helping engage fires in several states, you know, Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, Kentucky, so in Mississippi, like I said, it's really dry down there, and all the states are having, you know, extreme fire danger.
And Mowry says fire conditions there are much different than those that crews are used to battling in Alaska.
It's mostly leaves, you know, that have dropped from the trees. And these fires are burning across the forest floor. And, you know, these leaves can get blown around and create spot fires. And I think that's, you know, when you had winds in excess of 80 miles an hour in that Tennessee incident, I mean, it's really hard to do anything with fire like that that's going to move that quickly. It's almost like a grass fire.
While basic firefighting principles remain generally the same from fire to fire, Mowry says the difference in a fire's fuel can require that crews use different tactics than those used in Alaska's backcountry.
One of the big pieces of equipment that firefighters were using on our fire were leaf blowers, because these leaves were, you know, continually falling down and blowing off trees, and so they were constantly having to go back and clear areas with leaf blowers and rakes and things like that.
Mowry says it was a positive yet interesting experience to work in an area where residents are not as accustomed to dealing with destructive large-scale fires.
People were very, very supportive, very appreciative of, you know, not just Alaska, but every state that responded to the call to send folks there to help. So that was impressive to see. And that's, you know, you see that all the time everywhere. But, you know, it just seemed like this was an unusual sort of a historic event for them. And they were very thankful.
About 75 Alaska-based personnel remain in the region. Funding to fight the fires, which includes bringing Alaska crews down south, comes from a mixture of federal agencies and the states where fires are being fought. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska has settled into a notable stretch of seriously cold weather. Communities around the state are enduring low temperatures they haven't seen in a few years. And for more than a week, the average statewide temperature index has registered below normal, by far the longest stretch this year. Brian Brenschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage who closely tracks Alaska climate data and trends. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of a segment, Ask a Climatologist. He told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit, temperatures have dropped far below zero in the interior, and even colder temps are on the way.
For example, in Fairbanks, they reached minus 31 on Tuesday morning, and that's the first time that they've been below minus 30 in two winters. Now, in a typical winter, that happens about 20 times a year.
What's causing this?
Well, you know, cold air with the lack of sun, solar energy in the winter, if you can keep the warmth from the ocean away, cold air tends to build up in the high latitude areas. And those cold air masses, then they move with the upper air flow, the jet stream. And right now we're in a pattern where the flow is bringing some of the cold air that's been slowly building up over the last few weeks. It's dragging that into Alaska, and so we're all experiencing those below normal temperatures.
So for the entire state, we have the first below normal stretch.
Right. So basically, in the last 10 or 12 days, we've been below normal most of that time, which is the first stretch of below normal days we've had in 2016. And we've even had a significantly below normal day, the first one of 2016.
And you put this out on social media. What was the reaction that you got?
Well, from the reaction from some people is, okay, well, global warming, climate change, it's over now that the temperatures have become more Alaska-like. So, but I want to caution people that even the warmest year on record for Alaska, 2014, we still had about 60 significantly below normal days. So we've now had one, and we'll probably add to that here in the next 2 weeks. But even still, 2016 is almost a 100% lock to be the warmest year on record in Alaska.
Even if we spend the rest of the year below normal?
We'd have to have the coldest December of the last 40 years to not have the warmest year on record. So it's pretty much a done deal.
Brian Brenschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. Do you have a climate question for Brian? Email alaskaenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. There's no sign yet of a Palmer teenager who was reported missing more than 2 weeks ago. 16-year-old David Grunewald was reported missing by his family on November 13th after he failed to return home from a date. Grunewald's car, a Ford Bronco, was found burned a day later. Alaska State Troopers have asked the public for help in potentially locating surveillance video in the case, and there's a $10,000 reward that's been offered for information leading to Grunewald's recovery.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
What makes a modern warrior? According to Southeast Alaska's largest tribal organization, it's someone who fights to preserve subsistence rights or native languages. And it's those who work for clean water or care for other people's children. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Alfie Price co-leads a Tsimshian language practice group in Juneau. He's also learning the Tlingit and Haida languages. But when he accepted an award naming him as a language protection warrior, he began with another tongue.
I just wanted this room full of people to hear a few words of Eyak tonight.
That native language, once common in the area around what's now called Cordova, is considered extinct. Price is one of four people or families named as modern warriors by the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska during a recent celebration in Juneau. Price, who is also Tlingit, talked about the process of learning the language of his Tsimshian ancestors.
An unexpected side effect of learning Tsimalyuk, especially, is I found my own healing. The hurts and the things that made me bitter in my life are falling away. They're becoming light on my shoulders.
At the ceremony, Michiana Hutcherson was named warrior for protecting sacred lands and waters. Hutcherson is an activist who joined the Standing Rock Sioux protesting construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. She said the campaign's motto, Water is Life, is also important in her Tlingit homeland. That includes protecting transboundary rivers from industrial development on the Canadian side of the border.
We're standing up for our inherent rights in a way that we've never seen before. We're giving our kids and future generations something to be proud of and ensuring that we'll leave something behind tangible for them to hold on to, and that's each other.
Also honored was Harold Martin, named warrior for protecting traditional harvesting rights. The longtime Central Council subsistence director led numerous efforts to continue or preserve traditional harvests of seals, otters, and other marine life. Martin, a former logger, stressed the importance of continued schooling.
Education opens all kinds of doors. It's never too late to go back to school. I was 40 years old when we decided to go back to school in 1974. And I was able to go to work and still retire.
Veronica and Mike Coyle were named warriors for caring for our children. Surrounded by his large family, Mike Coyle talked about fostering kids and taking responsibility to raise them.
We never had any thoughts of adopting. We just wanted to do the right thing. When people need a place to sleep, you know, you just look out for your family.
The honors were presented at a November 22nd Native American Heritage Month celebration. Organizers said those recognized represented many other tribal citizens who also go above and beyond to advocate, protest, and protect. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks professor is pursuing a dream. Documentary film professor Rob Prince is on sabbatical in his former home state of Michigan, where he's acquired an iconic 35-year-old sports car. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the car is the centerpiece of a planned transcontinental trip and film project.
University of Alaska Fairbanks documentary film professor Rob Prince has fulfilled a long-held ambition.
For 20 years, I dreamed of one day owning a DeLorean. In the summer of 2016, that dream finally became a reality.
That's Prince in a Facebook video introducing the DeLorean he bought in Michigan and anticipating a documentary about taking the vintage gull-winged sports car across Canada to Alaska next year.
Drive my dream car 3,700 miles back to my home in Fairbanks, Alaska.
The juxtaposition of this really rare and futuristic-looking car in these kind of middle of nowhere Canadian towns.
Prince notes that the documentary project also eases the guilt of spending $30,000 on the DeLorean.
Legitimize a little bit this idea of getting a wholly unnecessary and impractical toy right about the time I turned 40.
Prince says his fascination with the DeLorean began after seeing it as a kid in the 1980s pop classic movie Back to the Future.
The Back to the Future movie introduced me to the DeLorean. But once I dug into the story behind it, I fell in love with the car itself outside of the film.
Prince recounts Maverick auto executive John DeLorean's vision of building the car in Ireland.
It's supposed to be this car that's going to end the troubles in Northern Ireland because there's going to be manufacturing jobs. And ending with John DeLorean getting busted for a cocaine deal in an effort to save the company.
The DeLorean company recently revitalized in the U.S. to again build the iconic car, which Prince says obviously still has plenty of fans.
People have followed me into gas stations to ask me about the car. People have taken selfies with the car as we're driving down the freeway out their window.
A family man, Prince knows the two-seater DeLorean isn't very practical, but says so far it's been fairly trouble-free, except for a while when it wouldn't start due to a fuse problem.
There were moments where I thought this is a huge, huge, huge mistake.
Prince says those feelings fit into another part of what he'll explore in his documentary.
This idea of what happens when you finally get something really big you've wanted for a very long time.
Prince recently launched an online crowdfunding campaign for his Back to Alaska DeLorean documentary project and says he's investigating sponsorship. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Annie Fite, and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan edited tonight's show. And I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT now or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.